You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org, broadcasting on your radio at 99.3 FM. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you're going to hear a conversation with the author Joseph Kertész, or Curtis. He's Hungarian. They say Kertész there, but I believe in Canada he goes by Curtis. His new book is The Afterlife of Stars, published by Little Brown earlier this year. In the second half of the show, I will then play an interview from the early days of Write the Book with Vermont author Catherine Davis. But first, we'll start with the interview with Joseph. Joseph Kertész was born in Hungary, but escaped with his family to Canada after the Revolution of 1956. He studied English at York University and the University of Toronto, where he was encouraged in his writing by Irving Layton and Marshall McLuhan. Kertész founded Humber College's distinguished creative writing and comedy programs. He was, for many years, Humber's Dean of Creative and Performing Arts and was a recipient of numerous awards for teaching and innovation. His first novel, Winter Tulips, won the Stephen Leacock Award for Humor. Boardwalk, his second novel, and two children's books, The Gift and The Red Corduroy Shirt, met with critical acclaim. Then his novel Gratitude won a Canadian National Jewish Book Award and the United States National Jewish Book Award for fiction. Kertész has also been a finalist for a National Magazine Award and the CBC Literary Award. His latest novel, The Afterlife of Stars, has been described by Anne Michaels as, quote, unforgettable and deeply moving, end quote, and by Miriam Toews as a masterpiece. It was released in the United States by Little Brown, as I said earlier this year. Here's some information about The Afterlife of Stars. As Russian tanks roll through the cobblestone streets of Budapest and shots ring out, young Robert and Attila Beck, inseparable brothers, peer from the boot of a toppled statue of Stalin at the first grisly signs of revolution. The year is 1956. That October day, Russian soldiers will storm their family home, prompting the boys' hurried escape from the city with their parents, grandmother, and two cousins. Not all will survive. Their immediate destination is Paris, the townhouse of Hermina, their great aunt, once a renowned opera singer and now a recluse who wears long gloves to preserve her dignity against a past scarred by unspeakable violence. Along the way, these two brothers encounter mysterious fellow travelers, witness the bewildering sights of a nation in transition, and grapple with rivalry and loss, while never losing their capacity for joy or their appreciation of humor and each other, as they stare down the unaccountable and the absurd. Robert, the younger, idolizes the fiery Attila, whose growing edge of anger and rebellion threatens to endanger them both. As exiles in Paris, they seek adventure and whatever semblance of home they might find, from the unfamiliar streets to the labyrinthine sewers beneath. When the duo uncovers a long-held family secret involving a double agent and a daring Holocaust rescue, this novel hurtles toward its cataclysmic conclusion. A fleeting decision by Attila has consequences that will last a lifetime, and the bond that has proved unbreakable may be the brothers' undoing. With dazzling storytelling and a firm belief in the power of humor in the face of turmoil, Joseph Kertész has crafted a fierce saga of identity and love that resonates through its final page. The Afterlife of Stars is not only a stirring account of one displaced family's possibilities for salvation, but also an extraordinary tale of the singular and enduring ties of brotherhood. I began my interview with Joseph Kertész by asking about his memories of the Hungarian Revolution of 1956 and the extent to which these very early memories, he was quite young, might have fed the afterlife of stars. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
You know, I was not yet five, so I have very scant memories of the actual events as I live them.
Right.
And I've done some research, and of course, you know, truth blends with fiction, but I have a few vivid memories. Some of them are depicted in the book, but I was in a I had a preschool activity that I went to each day, and my grandmother was tended to be my caretaker and caregiver, and she came to get me, but it was really odd because the preschool session had just begun. It couldn't have been more than 10 or 15 minutes after I'd arrived, and people were picking up their kids and grandkids as well. So anyway, I thought it was mysterious, but she said we had to go. And we lived in Budapest, and it was we lived very near the Grand Boulevard in Budapest called Andrássy, and my grandmother and I walked along Andrássy, and we saw this giant crowd forming, and it was there was a tank that I could see with a Russian star on it, and I could recognize that. And then she madly tried to get us away from there, but I looked up and I saw that every one of the lampposts on Andrássy, the Octagon it was called, had a Hungarian soldier hanging from it.
Yeah.
And it, you know, I mean, it wasn't exactly traumatic, I have to say, at first. But I looked up and there was a soldier right above us, and he seemed to be looking right at me. And I thought, oh, he's looking at me. He even had warm eyes. I still remember that.
Wow.
And I didn't realize he was dead, but I smiled at him, then my grandmother yanked my hand, and off we went, we tried to get around the crowd, and ended up at our place. And my brother was also home, which was really also mysterious to me. And everyone was scrambling around, and my parents said, "We're leaving." And I said, "Where are we going?" They said, "We're just getting out of here." And of course, I had no idea of the implications of all that. But
right.
But that night. So we each got to carry what we could, and I couldn't carry much. But that night we got onto a train. It was already dark. We got onto a train, and the train with hundreds and hundreds of other people, actually, way more than the train could accommodate. And the train took off, and it didn't stop at a station anywhere. It just stopped in the middle of nowhere. It was very, very dark, and the conductor said, "We need to get all of us get off the train." And there were, as I said, hundreds and hundreds of people. And then my family and all these hundreds and hundreds of people made off across this dark field in the middle of the night, very, very dark, actually, that night. And we started running. And every once in a while, a bomb would go off, and my older brother, who was 2.5 years older than I was, would look up and say, "Who is dropping these bombs?" And nobody would tell us until we made it to safety. And my grandmother said we had just crossed a minefield,
yeah.
Which was really extraordinary.
Oh, wow.
And I actually do remember we got to this single lamppost, a single solitary lamppost, and my dad said, "This is Austria." And I thought, wow, what a crappy country we've come to. We left home for this lamppost, right? And I thought, wow, this is amazing. But I also remember, because it was very traumatic for me, my grandmother was my favorite person in the world, and my dad took her bag, was his mother, took her bag, and felt like a rock collection. He said, "What is this?" And he opened it up, and it was full of records.
Oh, that's in the book, yeah.
Yeah, and it was they were her opera records, and he said, "What are you doing?" She said, I don't know where we're going. I mean, you know, maybe there's no music where we're going, He was furious, and he did actually break a couple of records on the pedestal of the lamp.
Yeah.
And I was horrified, and I was so angry at him. And then we went to Vienna from there. But I mean, we did stay overnight in this convent. That was also true.
Yeah.
But we went to. I have to tell you, I did a lot of research, obviously, on the events of the time of those weeks,
right.
But I had planned out the book very carefully, more carefully than any other book, and I had written up study cards, with a chapter of the novel. So I had 18 study cards, but what happened at this point for me in the process of writing this book was that it just took off on its own and began to write itself, and the boys really took off. I mean, the boys are twice as old in the novel as my brother and I were, but the boys took off and decided, went where they needed to go and asked the questions they needed to ask. But I had very little control of this. I mean, I've heard other people say this, and I remember one of my favorite novels, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Mark Twain said that, I didn't write The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn until it was ready to write itself. And this is exactly what happened here.
Yeah.
I mean, this might have been the first novel I should have written, but it was my sixth book of fiction. And it was amazing to me. And I thought, well, you know, I have a day job, so I can just go along with this and see where it takes me. And eventually I'll just throw most of it away. But in fact, most of it remained and has survived, you know, the cutting room floor.
Now, do you think, in retrospect, those study cards actually helped you find your way more quickly? Or do you think truly that they were left behind and something that you don't understand took over?
It's the latter entirely.
Yeah.
So it was really quite magical. And some of the scenes were, and some of the characters were extremely strange to me, like the guy who, the master perfumer, and all these people just disappeared, you know, and I thought, okay, well, I'll go along with this too. And Babette, later on in the novel, I mean, she I don't know what, that scene occurred to me in the middle of the night, and I just got up and wrote it. And thought, okay, this is going for sure. And it didn't. Everything survived, including the ultimate result, which I really, really broke me up. It was not what I had planned at all.
Oh, that's interesting. Did you, once you had written a draft, and I don't like giving away things in novels when I interview people, so let's not talk about what happens.
Okay.
But when you had finished the book, did you then go back to sort of fortify certain impressions or characteristics of different characters to better lead into what was going to happen?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, the second draft was really an overhaul. I mean, I thought, what do I have here? And so there was kind of a major overhaul, and I did do that, exactly that. You know, Aunt Hermina was never meant to be a major character, which is what she turned out to be.
Yeah.
And I actually thought that the parents weren't not credible, but they weren't full enough for me. So there was a lot of backfilling going on. For me, the most interesting character, obviously, was Attila, because Attila is, his personality is modeled after my older brother's personality, but he would have asked none of the questions Attila asked, but those were all my questions, and I needed somebody brazen enough to ask them, so he was kind of my spokesman, you know.
Well, that's really interesting, because Robert is your narrator, and he's the younger boy. But in a way, this book almost feels like it's narrated by both of them, because Attila is such a strong character, and he asks the questions, as you say. He's curious and intelligent and probing, whereas Robert is much more sort of contemplative, and he sits back and watches, which is a great aspect for a narrator to have. But I was going to ask you about developing these characters, the boys.
Yeah. Well, I realized after a couple of drafts that what I had certainly in Robert was a kind of Nick Carraway character who sees it all unfolding. And he's not exactly passive, but he's certainly the quiet one and the withdrawn one and maybe the peacemaking one. Whereas Attila was all the troublemaker, and I realized why Attila had become so important to me, because he was, he was really the catalyst for the novel's plot, and it was important to me to, obviously, and it might have been entirely unconscious, to point out to myself and to the world that you don't just get away free and clear with your mind clear.
Right.
After leaving behind, you know, 1,000 years of history in a country, you carry a lot of history forward. And there was a very dark history in the previous generation, World War II, before Robert's time. And so, I mean, that's part of, you know, the light he has to carry forward. He's part of the afterlife of that whole generation.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it until months later, actually, but it was important for me that it be Robert, because he was so innocent and so and both excited and horrified, you know, by all the events of his life. I mean, my family really left stuff behind. I mean, talking about not just the history, but my great grandfather, my father's grandfather, had many, many holdings all over the country and an incredible history, both cultural and, well, in every respect. So, I mean, everything had simply had to be abandoned, and that was the end of that. Including the language and the culture and the friends and the relatives and everybody. I mean, everybody did flee. Hungary, you know, the history is that during the time of the student uprising, ultimately a bit more than the students, there was you know, the borders opened. Russia had liberated Hungary from the Germans in 1945, but then never left. The Soviets never left. Mm-hmm. So they sort of squatted on Hungary. And because Hungary had been allied with Hitler, nobody cared until this uprising. And the world was very generous to Hungarian sling. It's not, it was the opposite of what's going on today, in a sense.
Yeah.
Refugees were not viewed as vermin by the rest of the world. And the United States and Canada, in particular, received many tens of thousands, and maybe even hundreds of thousands of people. And that was extraordinary. My dad said when we got to Vienna, there were buses at the station with European capitals on each of them, named on each of them, and you just get on any bus you wanted. You go to Rome, or you could go to Bern. It was amazing. So it was quite a thing. But the rest of the novel from Vienna we never went to Paris, for example.
Oh.
But the
how many of you were there?
So there were the five of us, and then there was a cousin, my father's cousin,
okay,
and his wife as well. So okay. We all fled. But the death of Judith, I don't know how that dropped on my plate, because that didn't occur. Judith and Andras,
yes,
the characters. Those people actually came. We were supposed to meet them, and something happened, and they were arrested. So they actually went to jail for a year. She was not pregnant at the time.
Oh, okay.
They went to jail for a year. So we were horrified that they had been seized and arrested, ultimately, and just thrown in jail.
Wow.
And taken back to Budapest. So, for some reason, that part of the story didn't work for me, and it was important for me to carry the story as I did, it's fiction, but in a sense, it's for me truer than any nonfiction could have been, because it really penetrated my own feelings about displacement and about loss and about the exciting possibilities ahead and so on and so forth. So
right.
All of that was obviously in my consciousness.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you have this history. It's part of you, and yet maybe you don't remember it well enough, and so you've written it. And now, of course, it's definitely very present for you, I'm sure.
It is. I mean, obviously, I know what's real and what isn't, but this fiction is realer to me, in a sense, than anything else I've ever written. So, I mean, it's obviously close to my heart for some reason.
And you've sort of mentioned this, but I did love how, as a reader, I was able to see the story unfold through a child's eyes. You know, both Attila and Robert take life in stride, and they're hyper aware, and they're ready for anything. They're ready for adventure. And I don't know if it's because of their age or if it's just something that's intrinsic in your writing, but they bring a very organic humor into situations, mm-hmm, that made it lighter and made it a little bit easier to be reading about all of the sadness. So I wondered if we could just talk a little bit about the humor in it. There's this one moment, let me see if I can find, there's this one moment, there's a baby born early in the book, and at one point they're at a funeral, the funeral that you just mentioned for the woman.
Mm-hmm.
And at the funeral, the baby, is it Gisela? Is that how you would say it?
Gisela.
So she, the narrative says, she wailed with such a redness and fury that when she got to the bottom end of the wail to take in a breath, the silence burned. That was so wonderful. But then later, Robert notes that she could have been taken from funeral to funeral to set the tone. And that was just so great, because it's like, there's just so much sadness, and then all of a sudden you get this light little moment from this wonderful young point of view. So I wondered if you can talk a little bit about infusing humor into a dark subject.
Well, I normally actually have a comic view of the world, and in some ways I inhibited that sense of comedy and satire. But it's always present, and, you know, in my experience and in my view, funny people, or even slightly funny people, are funniest when they're in terrible, extreme circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
My own father was funniest at funerals, actually. He was hilariously funny. It was terribly inappropriate and so on, but he had this in his personality. And so it just seemed to me that it was, A, it was a coping mechanism, but B, the world was absurd. The world is absurd. I mean, no offense, but I think of you guys down there going through what you're going through.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what the hell is that? It's just a completely absurd response to the problems of our time.
Yes.
Or the opposite of what you would hope there would be.
Yeah.
And your state has that wonderful Bernie Sanders, but I mean, we, by the way, Canada has a young Bernie Sanders as prime minister. I mean, we have like a 42-year-old Bernie Sanders as prime minister. And so it's like, and I'm not saying we're superior, because we do have a whole group of our population. We did elect Rob Ford in this city. Toronto's mayor was Rob Ford.
Yes.
Who was absurd as Trump.
Yes, I remember. He's gone now, right? He passed away.
He passed away, yes. I mean, tragically, but... but the thing is, the world swings all over the place and has these wildly different reactions to historic events. And I mean, when I think of the people, fleeing Aleppo, for example, today, Syria, I mean, these are not people who are going to blow up your country. They're people who are seeking shelter and food and comfort and jobs and schooling and those kinds of things.
Right, right.
So it's just... what I loved about having two young boys look at the world was that they were asking very fundamental and basic questions about the world. So, for example, when Attila interviews the Bishop of Szeged, by the way, that could have been 50 pages. I just had to stop it. It went on and on.
It was wonderful.
Thank you. But when he does, I mean, he's asking, really kind of obvious questions about things that have occurred to him, curious things, and they're funny, but they're also very fundamental. I mean, he's asking why, God even bothered to create the universe as many of the fundamental religions posit. And he's saying, I guess you have, if you're a creator, that's what you have to do. Like, and he was probably a better creator than a maintainer.
I think my favorite part of that was when he said, if heaven is so great, why is God always looking down on us? Why isn't he just enjoying it?
I know. I mean, I wrote that in a trance. It was in a frenzy, actually. I was writing and writing. And I suddenly realized I actually do have a million questions about all our assumptions, which is one of the... I think one of the main reasons the book is what it is that I really just wanted to question our fundamental assumptions about everything. And we just carry on as if we're so confident in our assumptions about things, and we shouldn't be confident about anything, really.
No.
I mean, and especially about the way we react to so many enormously important historic events.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the situation that the states are in right now, and if you look at who our president was, a year ago,
I know.
Who would ever have expected that this is what would unfold next?
I know. We want your president now as our prime minister, so I'm sure we're going to offer him a job if we can. I mean, he was unbelievable, and I thought, wow, America really gets it. When Obama was president, I mean, it was just so great. The world loved him, by the way. I mean, it was... He's just so, in so many respects, just the right person to lead a country, and especially lead the free world. So the swing in the other direction is tragic, but it's also hilarious in a certain kind of terrible way.
Yeah, and there's historical precedent for all of these sorts of things.
Yeah, for sure.
I thought in your narrative it was eerily prescient that one of Attila's questions, or some of Attila's focus, is truth, and what is truth, and doesn't truth matter? And I was like, ooh, yeah. Did you know that was coming?
No, I didn't know it was coming. So for me, part of the pleasure of writing this book was I didn't predict very much of any of that. So the fact that it survived, even for me, is a miracle, because it was a they were just thoughts that I had, and there they all were on the page.
Right, but they're thoughts that you had while you were studying history, and so that makes so much sense, right?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. For sure. So let's see. I wanted to ask you, this is just one little quirky aspect of Attila's personality, but it really charmed me. He has this way of addressing his brother using very endearing expressions. He calls him sweet pumpkin, beloved boy, my small brother, my ever curious darling. You know, and I think he's 13. So, I mean, it's not like he's like this big older brother. You know, they're really sort of, even though there's an age difference, they're sort of in the same stage of life a little bit. Maybe he's a little bit older, but I wondered how that came to you to talk about this aspect of his personality.
Initially, he is, mocking his parents, mostly his mother, who has endearments. So that's where it kind of begins. And it so happens that in my own life, my mother was full of endearments, and she was extremely loving. She had a very tragic start to her life, and I mean, my mother's parents and six of her siblings were murdered during World War II.
Oh my God!
So terrible. But she was this person, utterly determined to make things okay and to be positive. She made us feel good to be alive, and I mean, so there were three boys, and there were three of us in the family, but. So she always had these tremendous endearments, and I have a younger brother. So I have an older brother and a younger brother. I'm the middle, and mm-hmm. my older brother and I are not very close, but my younger brother and I are very close, and so it was kind of a running gag that we would just make up these stupid endearments, and they were actual endearments, but also mockery, you know. So
right.
He does say, you know, my sweet imbecile, and so on as well. So And believe it or not, I mean, here, this guy, my younger brother, is like, you know, the chief of ophthalmology at a hospital here, and a retinal surgeon, and we still write stupid emails like that. My darling little monkey, he writes to me. I mean, just yesterday, actually. So it just has persisted, and I, for some reason, it entered the novel, and I just, again, a number of people pointed that out, though. I mean, some object to the endearments, but, I mean, they seemed truthful to me or natural to me. So I
didn't object at all. I felt like it's either cultural and this is just sort of acceptable and a teenager would say this stuff without feeling embarrassment, but I thought it was funny and I thought it might be mocking their parents or it might be it was just great though, whatever it was.
It's all those things, yeah.
So I wanted to, part of the reason I'm going to ask this question is because I'm struggling with this a little bit in my own writing, and that is gesture in narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mind if I read just a little moment?
No, please.
So this is from, I don't know, like a fourth of the way into the book, and Robert is with his mother. She hugged me hard. "It will be all right, I promise," she said. The hug felt strange, possibly because of where we were and what had happened, all the excitement. It felt new, as if we were inventing the gesture. We floated up, both of us, on the suds of her hair, and then she kissed me and left, pulling the warm air with her. And so, you know, a hug in a book of fiction might come off as something just like really stock and like, oh, okay, so I don't know what to do here, so she hugs him. But this was just such a beautiful and fresh hug. And I just wondered if we could talk about gesture and finding the right gesture in a moment and making it special when it needs to be special and maybe omitting it altogether when a gesture isn't necessary.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's a great question. You know, I was really obviously in the moment when I wrote that, and it would have been, I kept thinking, you know, I often think that some writers are, you know, very much like actors in a sense, because they have to inhabit the consciousness of another human being or a younger human being or the opposite sex or an older man or whatever it happens to be.
Right.
And so... I guess the little passage you just read, I was really in the moment, and I was thinking, God, I mean, this guy is away from home. They're never going home. And there's his wonderful mother, who, you know, it was hard for me to make her even real because she was so, you know, wonderful in a sense, emotionally to me.
And strong, and so just like ultimately maternal.
Yes, exactly. So... It's a great question, actually, because it's very tricky. I remember Bruce J. Friedman, the novelist, who's still around, but unfortunately quite old, and I don't think he's writing anymore. But he said, there are only so many ways you can make people cry, and there are only so many ways you can make people kiss and hug and so on. And so you either pull back from that moment entirely, or you completely invest yourself in it.
Mm.
And that really stuck with me because I mean, in the instance that you read, that's exactly what happened. I was just so invested in that episode that it seemed, it was. I guess it was full of poetry for me too.
Yeah, it's very poetic, and I love that idea of either pull back or really go in, really commit yourself to it. That's a wonderful way to look at this. I mean, part of what I'm doing right now is going back through my narrative and looking for just sort of like meaningless smiles and nods and shrugs and things that I just like threw in there that are like, okay, I don't need this here at all. Do you do that afterwards, or do you find that you don't really need to do that because you're pretty much doing it as you go?
Well, I mean, it's a judgment call because, I mean, if somebody says something really funny, the other character should laugh, I guess. To not say that they're laughing. Or if something terribly sad happens, somebody should cry. But it depends, you don't want to, I mean, obviously you don't want to sentimentalize things, but you want to be true to the emotional moment. And so, I mean, that's a great question. I think it has to be done just by feeling, by instinct.
Yeah. This is actually a related moment in the book, or a related question, I guess. And that is, you use gesture and action very well to convey character. And this was just a tiny thing, but I thought it was so perfect. Robert says, "My grandmother was still squeezing my hand too hard, I thought, which is what people seem to be doing to me lately." And I thought, oh, that's so perfect, because you're never going to be able to tell us through the eyes of this 9-year-old boy what this 60 or 70 or whatever year old woman is going through. But you can tell us that she's squeezing his hand too hard. And we know exactly what that means in that moment, you know. And so that's another thing that gesture can do, is sort of like convey a whole lot of information without telling us specifically what's in someone's head.
Yes, that's very perceptive. That's exactly right. And if are you writing a novel, or is it?
Yep.
So yeah, I mean it's a vast terrain, and sometimes the gesture has no actual meaning except to be true to the moment. But sometimes it has much deeper meaning. So and it's true in Robert's case that everybody seemed to be gripping him too hard and holding his hand too hard. And so I mean that's exactly right. They're going through they're obviously going through a traumatic time. Everybody is.
Yes.
But he has limited perspective on it. And for me in this novel, another really tricky element of it, and I worked very hard with this tremendous editor, by the way, Ben George at Little Brown, but one of the things that I had to really consider was how far could I go without being overly dramatic or overly sentimental. Gestures were obviously what we're called, an explication of the gestures were what were often called for in this case, because he had to still remain a 9-year-old boy, but he had to, but he has a kind of, there are elements of the adult in there, which I had to be very careful not to overdo. So,
yeah.
I mean, the conceit that we had to work with in the novel was, is this an adult looking back, or how old is this person looking back? In the novel, The Book of Aaron by Jim Shepherd, I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I'm familiar with his work. I haven't read that novel.
But there's a kind of logical problem almost, because there is a 9-year-old narrator there too. But he's in the Warsaw ghetto and he's deported with a whole bunch of orphans, and you kind of think he's not going to make it. So then who actually did tell the story, and where is the story? Was it written down somewhere? I mean, there is a logical problem with a thing like that.
Right.
I guess you have to suspend disbelief when you read someone's fiction. If you like it enough, then the overriding quote-unquote mistake has to be acceptable to you. The illusion has to be acceptable to you. But so in my case, I wanted to have conveyed the thoughts that he should have had, but they're very mature in some ways, very precocious in some ways. So I had to be very careful not to overdo that.
Yeah, but I thought one way that you made that feel completely right was in giving him sort of analogies that he would make that were appropriate for his age. He made age-appropriate analogies to larger ideas. So, for example, when he talks about the difference in personality between himself and Attila, one of the things he says is, Attila, there's nothing gradual about him. No dawn, no sunset. To me, things seem gradual. I loved that section where he said, we are the adjective brothers, sudden and gradual. And so, like, that's a totally appropriate 9-year-old observation. And sometimes they can be very insightful at the age of 9, and yet it carries a much larger meaning. And because of the way it was presented, it doesn't seem too mature for him. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. That makes exact sense. And I always love grounding it in the things that he must be studying at school, like the parts of speech, adjectives, and
right.
decimal points, which is why they're 9.8 and 30, which, by the way, is not that easy to figure out, but he's 9.8.
I loved that. The book opens, and he says that I had just turned 9.8 years old, and then we learn that he's learning about decimals, but that was beautiful.
Right. And then the adjectives occur later.
Yeah.
One of the books I most admire, modern books, is The Remains of the Day by Kathy Roy Shapiro. And what for me is so great about that novel is that we are more aware of what's going on than the central character, the protagonist. And so I admire it so much because he's able to convey to the reader, look what's happening right through this guy's eyes, and he himself does not even know it's happening, or the truth of things. And so part of what I wanted to do was to have both the magic of childhood, but also to for adults to recognize that there are horrible, terrible things going on to humanity at this point, and continue to go on, and yet have the child's sense of wonder and horror
at
the same time.
Right, like Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird, which I try to limit the number of times I say that in a year of interviews, but.
Yes, like Scout, exactly.
You know, just like understanding without understanding, or conveying information without understanding.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that this book made me think about was the little details that might make everything worse in a terrible situation. So, for example, the family's disagreement about where to go. Like, they're in agreement that this is a dangerous place and we have to leave home now, which is what a horrible thing to have to decide in the first place. But then the father and mother have different ideas about where they should go. I've never really given that a great deal of thought, how this is not a small thing. You know, getting out is the biggest thing, but where to go next is not a small thing.
No.
And yeah, I just, I don't know, I appreciated being given the opportunity to think about, like, what else is involved in fleeing your country? And, I think we don't live that. We're very fortunate not to have to live that truth.
No, it's true. And when you're suddenly cast out there, I mean, it's kind of a lottery. So you, my parents always said, you know, we won the lottery. We came to this place where, I mean, my dad used to say, we came to a place without issues, essentially. I mean, of course, that's not entirely true, but there was that very much that feeling. He said he grew up until the age of 18. He had a very privileged life, and, you know, a chauffeur drove him to school. But then the whole world collapsed around him. World War II broke out when he turned 18. And he's, you know... But he said, you know, I lived in a place where, I mean, in where we, the new world, you can get bananas any day of the week. You have always have central heating. I mean, it's an incredible thing.
Yeah.
And we all take it for granted. We all take all the security and everything and freedom of speech and all these things for granted.
Right.
So it was a lottery. I mean, we could have gone somewhere. I mean, we could have gone, for example, to Israel, which is some of our relatives did. Do and you know, ended up fighting in 5 wars and having, you know, a terrible time to figure out where you stand politically. And I mean, many of my relatives in Israel are quite liberal, so they have a kind of smart Trump as their prime minister, And so, you know, we came to a place where there really isn't that much to worry about. Obviously, there is, but not, relatively speaking, not compared to the rest of the world.
No, so. I mean, everybody points to Canada as the one that did it right.
Yeah.
You know, New Zealand, I suppose, comes in second.
Yeah, and we often, you know, we're often rated as one of the two or three best countries to live in the world for all kinds of reasons, the healthcare and so on, cost of living and security. So we did sort of win the lottery by ending up here, and it needed to be part of the consciousness of the novel. What actually happened to us was when we went to Vienna, a great aunt of mine, my mother's aunt from the Bronx met us in Vienna, and it was a great moment because she, you know, first of all, she gave my family $1,000 to start with, and she said, "You have to come to the Bronx. I'm going to set you up, and you know, we have three butcher shops, in New York, and so on and so forth." And that night, my parents had this fantastic brawl about it. My dad said, "I'm not going to New York to become a butcher." And the true story is they actually, and my father had a cousin in Toronto, so they actually flipped a coin, and heads was Toronto, so we ended up here.
Wow.
But we could easily have gone to New York. Not that that would have been a bad thing, because I do think New York is spectacular, but it was just one of those, you know, you didn't really know where you were going and why you would be going one place instead of another.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, my mother had cousins who went to Venezuela. I mean, that ended up being a terrible mistake. So people were just scattered all over the world. In fact, there were people scattered you didn't even know if they were alive even after World War II. That was before my time. But, I mean, people just scattered all. Most of them died, but some didn't. And so people were turning up for decades after.
Now, are your parents still living?
No, unfortunately, they both passed away a few years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry. So they didn't have a chance to see this piece of work and give you their take on it.
No, I mean, they saw my last novel, which is kind of a prequel to this book.
Okay.
My dad said, when I started writing this one, he said, I hope you're not writing another book about me. That's what he said. he always ends up being a kind of bigger, larger than life character, actually.
Now, I wanted to ask you about a part of the book that associates with another craft question. Mm-hmm. So early in the novel, we find out that Robert loves going to the Café Gerbaud. Is that how you say it?
Gerbaud.
And there's a monkey there called Kaiser Laszlo that they keep in a cage, and he's just fascinated by this. But anyway, later in the book, he has a dream. I mean, they're far away from Budapest at this point, and he has a dream, and he returns to Budapest, and then he returns to the cafe, and he sees the monkey, and it's just this lovely dream sequence. Lovely. Well, I don't know. It's a dream sequence that informs the narrative in some ways. But so some people say you shouldn't write dreams in fiction, and especially at the beginning of a book, people say no dreams at the beginnings of books, and I never know what I think about that. But I was wondering what you think about that. Have you ever heard not to write dreams in fiction?
I have heard that, or if you have to have dreams, make them short.
Yeah,
have extended, you know, kind of a story within a story. Well, I mean, and this one was the one that survived in the book was quite a bit longer, and you know, Ben George helped me to cut it back. But I mean, it had a kind of, in this case, a kind of primal resonance. And so, I mean, again, this monkey reflects the absurdity of the humans around him, and he appeared in my last novel too, Gratitude.
So, I'm sorry, I haven't read that yet.
That's okay. It's no problem. But he seems to be obviously important to me because Gerbaud doesn't even have a monkey, so obviously he's really important to me.
Oh, and they never did. You made this up.
I made it up, yeah.
Okay.
I made it up. You know, there was a monkey in a cafe in Frankfurt, which I visited, this wonderful cafe in Frankfurt, Germany. And this, I don't know, I mean, that was several decades ago. So this monkey's obviously really important to me for some reason. And so I moved him to Gerbeau, which is really my favorite cafe, with wonderful, wonderful cakes. They must have 100 different pastries in there, all of which I've sampled. I go back to Hungary just to go to Gerbeau, but it's just so, what a terrific symbol of the culture that once was in Hungary, the fin de siècle culture of the last century.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, and I know that many of my ancestors visited Gerbeau. It's been around for hundreds of years, and so.
Yeah, I looked it up when I was reading your book, and it just looks spectacular.
Yeah, it is. It's spectacular. But I did. Sorry, I just realized I didn't really answer your question. So the question really is that. The answer really is that, you know, I think as a writer, you need to go with it and then ultimately in later drafts, see how important it is to, you know, to reflect on the meaning of the book and the themes of the book, I guess. That would be the answer. And sometimes, there were other dreams in the book that I crossed out. I mean, they just weren't as important to me.
Okay. Yeah, and I would think, too, if you're working, as you've said you were, where it's sort of like pouring out of you and not necessarily directed by study cards, then, you know, at the time, you don't want to interrupt that by deciding, oh, no, I'm not going to have this, you know, like later you can take it out.
That's right.
So you
can just, I think you should always tell yourself, you can just all take it out later. It's all good, you know. I mean, just let it come out and see where it ends up.
But what if it leads you in the wrong direction? Does that ever happen to you? Do you find that you all of a sudden are kind of going off down this plot stream that's not really leading you where you want the book to go?
Yeah, and it very often happens. You know, I mean, the most common question, as you know, a writer asks each day is, what if she goes down this alley instead of the other one?
What if they go to Venezuela?
That's right. What if they go to Venezuela? So it's a great question for a writer to pose to herself or himself each day, at each sitting, my view on it is you should allow the wrong turn and go down, and maybe it'll take you to the right place. You know, the wrong turn can take you to the right place.
Mm-hmm.
So, but if it doesn't, then on some level you end up in turmoil, and you know to go back and go back to the fork in the road and take the other path.
Yeah, which can be hard because it's a time investment as much as anything else, isn't it?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, if you write for the true reason that you want to express yourself and you want to find out the truth of your own world, then it's okay to take wrong turns. I mean, it is an investment in time, but it's time really well spent, I guess.
Yeah.
Honestly.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you about embedding clues in a narrative for secrets that we're going to find out later. So, and not necessarily huge secrets, but you know, the boys are led from home to this unknown world, and there's just everything is unknown. But then there are individual secrets that they're very fascinated by. For example, Great Aunt Hermina has injured hands that she keeps gloves on all the time. And so, you know, there's a clue as they're coming toward Paris, there's a mention of this. And Attila and Robert are very curious to know what happened to her. And you know, it unfolds eventually. We find out what happened. But I just wanted to know, as far as just like the larger idea of establishing mystery for a reader to wonder about along with a character and then eventually filling that in, if that's something you're thinking about as you're embedding these clues.
Well, in this book, I wasn't entirely sure where we were going. So, a lot of that is the kind of thing that you might want to insert in a later draft. But I had a vague notion that we were going where we were going, such as to Aunt Hermina's house, and I had a sense of what had happened to her. So, but not entirely.
Right.
This unfortunately is actually based on an actual great aunt of mine.
Oh no.
Who suffered that very fate.
Oh, my God.
So, so outrageously evil and preposterous that it just sort of, you know, I mean, I knew about it, you know, I was four when we left Hungary and they stayed, but that was what she had suffered 10 years before. So,
right. I won't give it away, but it's a terrible thing that is mm-hmm. torture. It's just awful. So,
and it was so, so terrible that I didn't know how you could even incorporate it in a fiction or if you should, but we did. My older brother and I actually did mock her. In retrospect, it's so horrifying because we didn't know what had happened to her, and she did have these, strangely deformed hands. Mm-hmm. So, anyway.
I don't think you need to beat up yourself over that. Kids just suck.
Yeah, I know. I know they do. They do. They really do. And there were other people we used to mock, and later I'm still getting over the guilt of it, but anyway, sorry. So do you? Yes. So I guess you do. This most often happens in a later draft, and it's made to look all the more clever for its being there. But I think you do have to plant seeds of things that are coming, and sometimes it does occur to you as you're going along, but most often, and this is why later drafts are so important, you know. There's some people like Peter Carey, the two-time Booker Prize winner, writes books 13 and 14 and 15 times, and from scratch, wow. Starts again. And so he doesn't just fix paragraphs. It's because he realizes that all the architecture has to be sound, and part of that is the little hints of what is to come.
Yeah. Actually, speaking of another author, I always like to ask my guests if they've read anything lately that they would recommend to listeners. Does anything come to mind for you?
I discovered Jennifer Egan.
Oh, yeah.
Later. I love her. God, her writing is so spectacular.
Yeah.
There's a coldish writer named Andrew Miller who I had never heard of before. And I read a review of him by Claire Massoud in the New York Times.
Oh,
and I just read his book, The Crossing. Plot ingenuity is tremendous in this book. And he's a wonderful writer and a wonderful craftsman, and yet there's a coolishness to it all, you know. So I really think of it as real third-person narration in the most objective sense, because very often third-person narration is very subjective. You follow one character, and you do in this one, too, but it feels as though it's an omniscient narrator, truly.
Okay.
I read books for style almost more than anything now. And I also discovered Sarah Waters in the past year and ended up reading five of her books. I mean, my favorite book in terms of the brilliance of the plot is Fingersmith, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a wonderful writer, rich writing. And I always admire people who can spin a yarn the way she did in Fingersmith. I mean, it's breathtaking how brilliant it is.
Yeah, and she really takes her time, and she really spins. You know, I mean, it's you're so immersed in her work.
Yes,
by the time everything unfolds,
it's completely real and credible. So for sure.
Yeah. All right, great. And then I wanted to ask what you're writing now. Do you have a new project?
Yes, I'm actually. Return more to comedy, and with my new novel, it's called Last Impressions, and I've done a draft of it, so I'm now revising it. But it's a dark comedy, inspired by the passing of my father, unfortunately. But he was such a larger than life character that.
If he made jokes at funerals, he would probably approve. So.
Yeah, he would. He would. I think so too.
So when do you think that's going to be complete?
I would love to have it ready to show within a year or two. Mm-hmm. My publisher would be great. I'd love to if it could come out in a couple of years.
Yeah. Okay, Joseph, I have one last question for you. Mm-hmm. I wondered if you had any advice for listeners who are writers about writing evocative setting that takes place during wartime. I was very moved by the settings in your book, and it struck me that, you know, these are settings that have a lot of nostalgia, they have original beauty to the narrator, and yet there's horror going on in these settings. You know, and I think you've got Great Aunt Hermina saying something about darkness and light moving together, and the setting made me think of that. Do you have any advice about that?
Well, there was a boys' school, a high school in Toronto, that all the poor boys had to read my book, but they were all discussing it. I mean, it's a great question because the school is happens to be on the street where I grew up in Toronto, and and it was so. I mean, for me, that's it was a kind of paradise. That street, I loved it so much.
Oh, wow.
So I said to the boys, because someone asked me a similar kind of question, and I said, so imagine your favorite place and imagine sitting down and watching it be blown up.
Mm.
And that is how it feels. I mean, war is obviously horrible, but it's also, you think of your home as kind of, you know, eternal in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
You don't ever expect it to be taken away from you in the most violent way. So, again, that was very true to me and very real to me because, you know, obviously I experienced it at a very tender time in my life. So, and also, I mean, we were displaced. I mean, my first language was Hungarian. I mean, everything was taken. So there's and that's why that dream that you mentioned is important as well, because he's going back to a place that was really, you know, his cradle. It was the place, safe place where he began life, and it was you know, taken out from under him. So,
yeah,
I guess that's why it ended up being, it was poignant without my even having to try. So if you imagine your favorite place and have it and have that person lose it in some terrible way, that's the way it will come out.
Yeah. Well, okay, great. Thank you. Thank you for that. I want to just mention again, the book is The Afterlife of Stars by Joseph Curtis or Kertész, depending
right. That's
on
right.
Where yeah. you're from, published by Little Brown. Joe, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author Joseph Curtis. His novel, The Afterlife of Stars, was recently published in the United States by Little Brown. I want to just mention that the views expressed on Write the Book are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WBTV LP, its management board, or any of its affiliates. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. So, for example, my interview today with Joseph Kertész will be up as a podcast in the next couple days, and you can listen to it in its entirety at that point. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And then, of course, you can stream the show live each week at 993wbtv.org, Mondays at 3. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. Have a great week.